limit proliferation for stability and to reduce the chances of some kind of nuclear exchange is the rationale for it. But it's certainly viewed as hypocritical by a lot of countries. It's not really fair.
Welcome back to None of the Above. I'm Mark Hanna. This season, we're bringing you a limited series all about the foreign policy decisions of the 1990s and how they continue to shape the world today. Previously on 90s Rewind, we discussed CIA covert operations in Afghanistan and the terrorist threat that emerged from the ensuing Civil War. Also, the attacks against the United States that would soon follow on September 11, 2001. While Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups emerged as serious threats in the 1990s, U.S. policymakers were focused on reducing a danger which had shrouded nearly every Cold War interaction.
A silo is destroyed and the former Soviet Union moves closer to reducing its nuclear armory.
The launch of the missile comes 11 months after India conducted a series of underground nuclear explosions. That prompted Pakistan to respond with tests of its own, raising international fears of a nuclear arms race among the two nations.
The Ukraine gave up the last of its 2,000 nuclear warheads to Russia in June as part of an agreement it signed with the United States and Russia.
The turn of the decade ushered in a new sense of optimism about the potential for nuclear disarmament. George H.W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev signed a historic treaty to significantly reduce the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union. But by the end of the 1990s, the picture was more troubling.
It's important to remember as we're looking at the 90s that it was a bit of a mixed bag, though, when it came to nuclear weapons. So it's not quite the golden age that sometimes people really present it as.
That's Emma Belcher, president of Plowshares Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to reducing the threat of nuclear weapons.
We did have some terrific successes when it comes to disarmament. We had the negotiation of START 1, which by 2001 had really reduced the stockpiles 80% of nuclear weapons from what they were. So that was really a terrific success. You also had success in cooperative threat reduction programs with Russia. Concern with the fall of the Soviet Union, of loose nukes falling into the wrong hands, what would happen with former Soviet states and the nuclear weapons there.
The threat of catastrophic nuclear war had hung over the United States, the Soviet Union, and really, because of their immense destructive power, much of the world throughout the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union raced to build up their arsenals and poured resources into developing faster and more accurate and more powerful weapons than the other. This raised the stakes of the era's biggest crises, and the two superpowers came to the brink on numerous occasions.
Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us.
That was President John F. Kennedy addressing the United Nations in 1961, 1 year before the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most dangerous period of the Cold War. He would go on to sign the first nuclear arms control agreement, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, in 1963. By the 1980s, policymakers came under intense public pressure to change course.
Nuclear weapons, I think, play a fundamental role in shaping how the Cold War comes to an end, when, where, and how it does. And that's because in Europe in particular, the nuclear competition frames so much of how everyone from high-level policymakers to individual people on the street think about the Cold War in the 1980s.
This is Susan Colburn, who we've had on before on episode 2. She's a historian and a professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy.
And so nuclear anxiety is sky high in the early 80s. It's everywhere in popular culture. It is on television sets. It's on the radio. It's in the James Bond franchise. And in nearly every Western European country, you have record-breaking protests. Some of them are still the largest protests in American history, in Dutch history, and things like this. A few of them have been surpassed by the protests against the Iraq War in 2003. But these were huge, massive demonstrations. And that nuclear anxiety drives and encourages a number of policymakers to start to think about how they can address the nuclear dimensions of competition with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And a lot of policymakers share the anxieties of their constituents who are on the street.
The United States and the Soviet Union had come to the brink of nuclear war before. In 1962, the Soviets secretly placed nuclear missiles in Cuba to deter a U.S. invasion. In response, the United States started a naval blockade of the island nation. After 13 days, John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev came to an agreement. The Soviets agreed to dismantle their offensive weapons in Cuba, and the U.S. did the same with their weapons deployed in Turkey. It was later revealed just what a close call the incident had been.
If you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 60s, that was very much a wake-up call, that we came so close to nuclear war that that then crisis sort of paved the way for the beginning of negotiations and the recognition that we really needed to engage with our adversary in reducing our weapons and engaging its arms control. So then by the 90s, we see, you know, from the beginning of that decade, those efforts and the successes and the fact that it was probably a combination of negotiations, treaties, and activism that really helped bring down those levels. You know, from the height of the Cold War, we had between the US and Soviet Union around 60 to 70,000. Over time, then it reduced down. Today, we're about 12,000, although we're currently poised to increase that number the first time in decades, undoing a lot of that good work.
Efforts to bring that arms race under control by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev led to warming relations between the two countries and a flurry of activity on nuclear disarmament in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
And so when we think about the big breakthroughs that start to signal that the Cold War might be coming to an end, we think of things like the INF Treaty, right, where Reagan and Gorbachev agree for the first time to dismantle an entire class of nuclear weapons. It's only about 3% of their respective arsenals, but because it is an entire class of nuclear weapons, it seems significant and seems to herald a new era. You have renewed negotiations about conventional forces in 1989. They had been a subject of debate for many years before, but come into effect. And then, of course, the strategic arms talks as well. I think nuclear weapons then, as we move into the immediate post-Cold War world, they become a crucial proving ground of assistance to the former Soviet Union, of technical cooperation, of civil-military relations and cultivation. I mean, we think about the amount of money the United States invested in the early 1990s to secure the nuclear arsenal of the former Soviet Union, right? Offering funding and technical assistance and missions and support to secure weapons that had ended up in Ukraine or ended up in Kazakhstan, or to help the Russian Federation, right, manage this downsizing and change in relationship.
The Soviet Union dissolved in December 1991, and its vast nuclear arsenal was dispersed across four newly independent states: Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. A big focus of diplomatic efforts in the 1990s was bringing all those nuclear weapons under Russian control.
The general view, really, amongst a lot of people, but I think at the time then, was the fewer the number of nuclear weapons states you have, the fewer different kinds of control systems you have over them, the better, because that is less likely to result in some kind of nuclear war, either intentionally or by mistake. And I think there was probably concern that in those countries, what was the control mechanism over those weapons? Because they really were under the control of Moscow. So Moscow was the one that owned and controlled those weapons. They were posted on other countries' territories, but they didn't really have the sort of infrastructure to be able to maintain those weapons by themselves. And I think there was grave concern that in the wrong hands, something terrible might happen. So it was in, I think, both the Soviet Union's interest and the United States' interest to make sure that those weapons were repatriated to Moscow so that you had one country there that had control over all of the weapons.
The decision for Ukraine to relinquish its nuclear warheads is somewhat controversial now. Some think that had Ukraine kept a nuclear deterrent, it could have prevented future Russian aggression. Susan Colburn raises a critical distinction.
Ukraine had historically in the Soviet period been the site of defense production, including nuclear weapons production, had many talented scientists, and also had weapons facilities. But what the Ukrainians inherit is not a nuclear capability. They inherit weaponry. They do not inherit the command and control structure. They do not inherit the ability to use them. And so they don't inherit a nuclear arsenal in the sense of what we often think of that meaning. And it's really crucial for understanding the options that were available to the Ukrainians in the 1990s. So they end up in lengthy negotiations about how they will relinquish these weapons, about how they will join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. And it's these deliberations that end with the signing of the Budapest Memorandum, which is this agreement signed by the United Kingdom, the United States, and the Russian Federation to guarantee the territorial integrity of sovereign and free Ukraine. And so we've seen in recent years, obviously, some return to that history, to wondering if there were different alternatives or different options. But the weapons themselves were not the sort of most fanciful version of the Ukrainians keeping them and using them in some way. It's not really a viable option on the table.
Our recurring guest, Ambassador Thomas Pickering, was part of the diplomatic effort to bring the nuclear weapons back under Moscow's control.
On a number of visits, Vice President Gore came and we had bilateral meetings with Prime Minister Chernomyrdin. And we worked on questions such as, how can we achieve the removal of Russian nuclear weapons from Ukraine? And how can we get Ukraine to go along? And we planned joint approaches to the President Kuchma in Kyiv to work out how and in what way the Russians would receive back the nuclear weapons, which were part of Soviet forces deployments to Ukraine, but would be recovered by the Russian Federation. And the Ukrainians were reluctant, but did over a period of time go on. And President Clinton and Vice President Gore, as well as President Yeltsin and Prime Minister Chernomyrdin, all played diplomatic roles in making that process go forward. Some of that resulted in the Budapest Memorandum, which, as you know, was a kind of guarantee of Ukrainian sovereignty, which bit the dust when Russian military activity against Ukraine began much later in the first decade of the 21st century.
The Budapest Memorandum was signed in 1994. Russia, the United States, and the United Kingdom provided security assurances to Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan in exchange for those countries turning their nuclear weapons over to Russia and joining the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT. The NPT was negotiated in the 1960s and entered into force in 1970.
It started off as a negotiation between the United States and the Soviet Union, because they recognized the problem of proliferation to further countries. And so that was really the motivation. Then as they negotiated it, I think they recognized they needed to bring in those countries that they wanted to sign up and agree not to proliferate further. But in order to do that, they had to come up with an incentive or a grand bargain. And so what they basically said is that if you countries that don't have weapons agree not to get them, we will facilitate the development of nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. So you're forgoing the technology for weapons, but we'll help you develop it for energy, for medical uses, but you have to agree not to develop the weapons. And that, I think, was one part of the agreement. But there were countries that said, well, hang on a minute, how come you get to have them indefinitely and we indefinitely say that we won't get them? And the grand bargain, the other part of the bargain there was that those countries that had them agreed to eventually reduce the numbers and disarm to zero. And so this is where the kind of tensions are arising now, because that was a very vague commitment. There was no time frame. There's no real kind of enforcement mechanism to punish the countries for not living up to their agreement. So what we see there is the NPT that came into force in 1970, and it really... Kennedy's predictions in the 60s were that we'd have tens of nuclear weapon states by probably earlier than now.
President John F. Kennedy's prediction turned out not to come true. As of today, only 9 countries possess nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, China, the UK, France, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea.
So we have those who are part of the NPT, US, Russia, China, France, and the UK. And they've signed up at various points over time. There are countries that were actually looking at their own nuclear weapons programs, including my own country, Australia, that actually abandoned them and joined the NPT. South Africa is a country that did have a weapons program and then later joined the NPT. And I think what we've seen is that's been really successful. Now, here's where the other countries come in. What's really interesting is that India was a big proponent of this sort of NPT agreement, and it was involved in negotiations, but it ultimately decided not to sign up because it didn't think that the agreement was fair. It felt that it was agreeing not to develop weapons, and the other countries who had them already weren't being forced to disarm in a timely manner. And that, I think we can see what happened then, is that India goes to develop its own weapons and Pakistan then goes to develop its own weapons. So you have that kind of regional proliferation. Israel is another country. It doesn't, of course, acknowledge formally that it has nuclear weapons, but by all accounts, it does. And then we have North Korea, which was a party to the agreement, but it did what some people would call cheating from within. And it developed the program while it was still a party, and then it withdrew. So this is really the cornerstone treaty. And what we see now with the threats of Iran getting a weapon, which would then likely bring about a cascade in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, when we see now countries like South Korea and even people in Germany talking about the need to develop nuclear weapons, we could start to see a sort of unraveling and fraying of the NPT and proliferation in a way that is incredibly dangerous.
Back to 1991, George H.W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START. The bilateral agreement pledged to reduce each of their nuclear stockpiles from more than 10,000 warheads to below 6,000. It entered into force in 1994 and became one of the most successful arms control agreements in history. By 2001, 80% of the world's strategic nuclear weapons were dismantled. In 1992, the United States, Russia, and 25 other countries signed the Treaty on Open Skies. It would allow member countries to conduct scheduled surveillance flights over another's territory in an effort to promote mutual transparency and trust around military capabilities. In January 1993, just before Bill Clinton's inauguration, George H.W. Bush and Boris Yeltsin signed START II, which would further limit the number of strategic nuclear weapons held by the United States and Russia to 3,500 each.
In this ornate hall of the Kremlin, with a simple stroke of the pen, the two presidents committed their countries to the most sweeping disarmament agreement ever signed. In Mr. Yeltsin's words, a treaty of hope. And Mr. Bush, in the twilight of his presidency, raised his glass to a new morning of peace.
Things were looking pretty good, right?
Now, START II was not actually ever enacted. And so, you know, it might seem like a long amount of time between, you know, 93 and then 2001. But I think things happened in that period that meant that both countries ratifying the agreement was actually stalled. And so by the time they kind of came to the point to actually enact it, other political changes had happened, including the US withdrawal from the ABM treaty.
The optimism of the 1990s would quickly fade as relations between Russia and the United States began to deteriorate. You can listen to our previous episode, episode number 2, for more on that.
I mean, I think with the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a kind of euphoria and optimism and everything's over and we can be peaceful and this is just going to be the continuation. And disarmament was, I think, just seen as a fait accompli, something that was just going to happen. And I think there was a sense of triumphalism and great positivity. But then over time, you see political context shift and change. And really by the early 2000s, where we see the United States withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that was a turning point, really. And we see that the Russians then decided not to accede to START II, because part of their premise of signing on to START II was that the United States did not develop a missile defense system. And at the time, George Bush stated that we no longer needed this treaty because geopolitics had changed. Russia was no longer seen as the sort of adversary that it was, or the Soviet Union was during the Cold War, and that now we had the global war on terror. So after 9/11, his view was that having limits to be able to develop a missile defense system was actually impeding our ability to protect the United States from terrorists. So that, I think, signaled a real shift.
The global war on terror marked a turning point. George W. Bush withdrew the United States from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, or ABM, which was signed in 1972. In response, Vladimir Putin withdrew Russia from START II the very next day. Another war 10 years earlier also proved consequential for nuclear proliferation. The 1991 Gulf War. After Iraq invaded Kuwait, the U.S.-led coalition defeated Saddam Hussein's army in just 5 weeks. After the decisive victory, India's military chief of staff reportedly took away an important lesson. Quote, "Never fight the United States without nuclear weapons."
You see the logic in it. I think the challenge is recognizing the fact of the unintended consequences, potentially, of what could happen. And I think it pinpoints the importance of trying to anticipate ahead of time. If I do something that potentially increases incentives or perceptions of incentives about the need for nuclear weapons that could lead to proliferation, really trying to plan ahead and think about what do you need to do to try to engage potentially some of those countries who could take the wrong lesson to give them kinds of assurances that could prevent that proliferation. So in my view, I wouldn't have said, don't do it because of nuclear proliferation risks, because the world is very complex and very nuanced, and you can't be so black and white as to say, well, I don't want nuclear proliferation, so let's not worry about anything else that happens in the world. But really try to manage those risks. I think that is the important lesson. Now, when we get to the second Iraq war, I mean, if you want my point of view, I really think that was unnecessarily and highly dangerous. And we do see those lessons. And in fact, we see the lesson after that with Gaddafi actually having given up his weapons. And we saw what happened to him. And then we saw what happened to Saddam Hussein.
Both North Korea and Pakistan began developing their nuclear programs in the 1950s and intensified their efforts in the 1990s. In 1994, North Korea abruptly refused to admit inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency and threatened to withdraw from the NPT. Crisis ensued.
The United States and the international community demand that North Korea open up its nuclear facilities to inspection. North Korea at first cracks the door open, then slams it shut. The nuclear gambit leaves both sides watching each other warily across a border bristling with weapons and tension.
The U.S. was seriously considering military strikes on the Yongbyon nuclear reactor, and Washington was confident it could defeat North Korea if a full-scale war broke out. Thankfully, we never had to find out. Former President Jimmy Carter volunteered to travel to North Korea and negotiate with Kim Il-sung. The outcome of that meeting was a 1994 agreed framework.
The agreed framework, that was when it was negotiated, or when it was agreed upon, by a former boss of mine, actually, Bob Gallucci. So the agreed framework really limited what froze North Korea's plutonium program. And this was really essential because it kind of froze in amber where the North Koreans were in developing nuclear weapons, in developing a program. But unfortunately, from 2003, that was when the United States decided to withdraw from the agreed framework. So the intention was to prevent North Korea, which was moving in the direction of acquiring nuclear weapons, from ever doing so.
The deal was effective for a while. It froze the operation of the nuclear reactor at Yongbyon and the construction of two other reactors and established a monitoring program. Then North Korea tested a ballistic missile in 1998. Secretary of State Bill Perry later said that the test was not a big threat to United States security, but it was made into a major issue by members of Congress, particularly Republicans, who were opposed to the agreed framework and accused the Clinton administration of appeasing a dictator.
You know, Clinton nearly got a missile deal with North Korea, but the Bush administration abandoned talks. And then North Korea tested its first weapon in 2006.
George W. Bush decided to abandon the agreed framework in 2002. North Korea promptly withdrew from the NPT, expelled weapons inspectors, and resumed its nuclear program. Today, Pyongyang possesses an estimated 50 nuclear warheads. Also racing to develop a nuclear weapon in the 1990s, with help from China, was Pakistan, claiming it needed a deterrent against its nuclear-armed neighbor and adversary, India. India conducted its first test of a nuclear weapon in 1974, dubbed the Smiling Buddha. India called it a peaceful nuclear explosion, but spent the next two decades increasing its nuclear arsenal and building a delivery system for military deployment. Recall from our previous episode that the United States had a tense but working relationship with Pakistan. Washington was trying to elicit cooperation on both the emerging threat of terrorism in Afghanistan and Pakistan's nuclear program.
We spoke frequently and often to the Indians about their following the path of moving away from nuclear weapons, non-proliferation, other kinds of approaches, and the value that this would have in the work we were doing with Pakistan to try to guard against their moving toward nuclear weapons. That fell apart in the middle of the 90s, as we have seen. Since then, we have worked very hard to try to continue to do whatever we can to block trade in materials and technologies and equipment that's essential for countries seeking to proliferate.
The United Nations adopted the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in 1996 to ban nuclear explosions. President Clinton signed the treaty, but Congress voted against its ratification. India faced increasing pressure to curb its nuclear program, but considered a nuclear deterrent essential to its security in an international system dominated by nuclear-armed powers. In May 1998, India conducted Operation Shakti, detonating five nuclear weapons in a northern desert. Here's Prime Minister Vajpayee.
We do not intend to use these weapons for aggression or for mounting threats against any country. These are weapons of self-defense to ensure that India is not subjected to nuclear threat or coercion. We do not intend to engage in arms race.
Just a couple weeks later, Pakistan followed suit, testing nuclear weapons for the first time. Five underground nuclear explosions were conducted near the border with Afghanistan. Pakistan has struggled with the internal threat of terrorism, and many experts worry its nuclear weapons could fall into the wrong hands.
This has been a concern, particularly after the war on terror or after 9/11, but it's still a concern now. Pakistan is one of those countries where I think the threat and the risk is particularly high, and that's partly because of the way in which they move their nuclear weapons around the country in unmarked vans to try to have sort of an element of surprise, I suppose. But if you think about,
nuclear submarines, but
slightly more visible.
Yeah, slightly more visible, slightly less sophisticated.
Exactly.
In the back of a RAV4 or something.
Right. Okay. And if you think about the potential of some kind of terrorist group to intercept that.
Right.
I mean, that is really chilling. And I think a lot of the attention has, you know, rightly focused on Ukraine and Putin's threats to use nuclear weapons. But that doesn't mean that the risk in South Asia has gone down. I think South Asia was very much a focus before Putin's invasion, but it, for me, remains a focus and maybe the most likely place we're going to see a nuclear weapon be used.
Pakistan also has not declared a nuclear use doctrine.
Nuclear use doctrine is really a way to kind of signal to other countries what you would be intending to do so that it sort of clarifies for others and that they can have a certain sense of assuredness, I suppose, about what they might be doing.
But even while many states do have a public nuclear use doctrine, uncertainty remains.
I don't really know how ultimately satisfying that is. So I think, you know, China has sort of had a no first use policy, which means it won't actually use a nuclear weapon first. And there have been a lot of arguments for the United States to take that policy as well. And actually, President Biden, when he was campaigning, expressed support for that policy and then walked it back. But when it comes to China, you know, there's a question about, well, China can say that, but does anyone actually believe it?
So as the 1990s drew to a close, the United States and Russia had achieved historic levels of disarmament, but cooperation grew shaky. Pakistan had newly acquired nuclear weapons, and the nuclear agreement with North Korea was on the verge of breaking down. A mixed bag, as Emma puts it. Thomas Pickering considers avoiding nuclear conflict one of the decade's major foreign policy successes.
I can pick the most useful success, in my view, is to have dealt with a wide plethora of what I would call first-grade challenges without getting into a global catastrophic nuclear conflict. And we attempted to deal with it with a mixed record, which meant that it was not entirely solved in the 90s or the first two decades of the current century, and still sticks with us.
Many more countries opted to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty than not, but wealthy and powerful nuclear-armed countries advocating for non-proliferation may strike some as hypocritical.
If you talk about it in terms of fairness, it's not really fair, you know? I think looking at it in terms of trying to limit proliferation for stability and to reduce the chances of some kind of nuclear exchange is the rationale for it. But it's certainly viewed as hypocritical by a lot of countries. And then civil society organizations have gotten fed up with this hypocrisy that they see of the US, Russia, and China in particular, that they, as parties to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, have committed to reduce the number of weapons to zero, to disarm to zero. And they see that there's just a lack of progress on this while they're getting lectured about not proliferating. And we see that this has really now taken the form of a new treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW. And this has really been led by efforts of countries like Ireland, Mexico, Austria, New Zealand, with strong civil society actors, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, that later won the Nobel Peace Prize for this work. And what they did is that they came together to create a treaty that would ban and outlaw nuclear weapons. And what's interesting is that no one thought it would succeed. And today it came into force in 2021. It has 73 parties and 94 signatories. And this is something that I think is a real expression of the desire to see much more movement from the nuclear weapon states and a sort of an end to the hypocrisy. So whether you like it or not, because there are no nuclear weapon states that are part of it, there are no allies of nuclear weapon states that benefit from extended deterrence, and whether or not it's actually going to lead to those countries who are not part of it actually disarming, it's highly unlikely.
Fast forward to today, and several nuclear arms agreements have broken down. But President Trump has expressed interest in negotiating a new trilateral agreement with Russia and China.
I think if Trump can negotiate an agreement with Putin and Xi Jinping, that would be terrific. Whether or not he's going to be able to do it, I highly doubt that China is going to be willing to come and have negotiations with the United States and Russia, or just the United States. Because what we've heard China say repeatedly is that it wants to get to parity before it begins any kind of negotiation, so it's not entering a negotiation with less leverage. And they really have resisted having talks even about strategic stability.
U.S. nuclear competition with Russia and China today looks arguably much different from the Cold War, and many policymakers support efforts underway to modernize America's nuclear arsenal.
When it comes to planned modernization, this is looking at sort of replacing intercontinental ballistic missiles, replacing bombers, and replacing submarines to the tune of at least $1.7 trillion over the next few decades. Now, that is an eye-watering amount of money. I do actually think there's a case for some modernization, right? We can't have weapons systems that are not safe and secure while we've got them. So yes, there needs to be a certain level. I would say on the floppy disks, part of that actually helps insulate the nuclear weapon system from, you know, being connected to the internet in a way that opens up a whole lot of vulnerabilities. But I do think we need to take a critical look at what are the systems we're investing in and how much money are they going to cost? Because I don't think that all of them are absolutely necessary. And we're already seeing cost overruns. We're already seeing things be really delayed to the point of, are they actually going to be able to be effective? So making sure that we're looking realistically and figuring out how much do we really need to spend is critically important.
The question of incorporating artificial intelligence into weapon systems has also been raised.
I think this is critically important when we think about the future, and people are worried about the potential for machines to be making decisions over nuclear weapons use. Now, there are some, you know, there's a neuroscientist, Miran Cerf, who has an argument, and I don't know if he believes it or if he just is putting it out there, that given the way the human brain responds to pressure, maybe machines would be better at making these decisions because they aren't subject to the kind of pressure that human beings would be. So they might make more rational decisions. Now, that might be all very well, but that sends a chill down my spine, and I think most people's spines.
In its 2022 Nuclear Posture Review, a policy document that outlines the role of nukes in national security strategy, the United States pledged to always keep a human in the loop for decisions related to nuclear weapons use. And there is evidence that a human's gut instinct could be the difference between business as usual and the end of life as we know it.
You know, there's an example from the 80s of a Russian, well, actually a Soviet officer who received information that the Soviet Union was under attack by Minuteman missiles from the US. And his job was to relay that up the chain. And he famously said he had a funny feeling in his gut that it was wrong, the information he was receiving, and he didn't relay it up the chain. It turns out that it was a glitch and there were no weapons coming, but he could have inadvertently started World War III by mistake. Now, my question is, can artificial intelligence get a funny feeling in its gut and prevent the start of World War III and catastrophe?
That close call, among others, was sobering for American and Soviet leaders at the time and contributed to mutual understanding that the world would be better off with fewer nuclear weapons. The end of the Cold War and thawing relations enabled the United States and Russia to dismantle 80% of the world's strategic nuclear weapons over the course of the 1990s, a massive success. On nonproliferation, the decade has a mixed record. South Africa possessed 6 warheads by 1989, but decided to dismantle all of them and join the NPT in 1991. Pakistan and North Korea have since joined the ranks of nuclear-armed states, and Iran is reportedly on the verge of building a bomb. It remains to be seen whether the US and China will cooperate on nuclear weapons or embark on a renewed arms race. The 1990s opened with optimism about the prospect of a world with fewer nuclear weapons. U.S. policymakers were also feeling hopeful on another front, the Arab-Israeli conflict. The 1991 Madrid conference opened a much-needed dialogue between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But the decade ended in bitter disappointment. We explore that next time on None of the Above. Thank you to Emma Belcher, Susan Colburn, and Thomas Pickering for joining this episode. Our producer is Eloise Cassier, and our associate producer is Sarah Leeson. Special thanks to our None of the Above team, Jonathan Geyer, Lucas Robinson, and Ransom Miller. Our intern, Juliana Lozada, also helped with this episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please consider sharing this episode with a friend or family member. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find podcasts. You can also find us on X at Podcast Nota, that is at Podcast Nota. Rate and review us, especially if you're generous and want to give us 5 stars. We appreciate it. Please send us your comments at info@noneoftheabovepodcast.org. I'm Mark Hanna. Thanks for tuning in.